This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After fighting in the Vietnam War, my guest Jim Northrup returned to the reservation where he was born, the Fond du Lac Reservation in northern Minnesota. Northrup is Anishinaabe, also known as Ojibwe or Chippewa. He's trying to live within his culture's traditions. When he returned to the reservation, he lived in a teepee for 6 years, but that wasn't just about tradition, it was also the result of a housing shortage on the reservation. Northrup was taken away from the reservation when he was 6 years old and sent to a government boarding school. Now he writes about his life and about the issues and controversies on his reservation. He's a columnist for several Native papers and for the Minneapolis Star Tribune and the Duluth News Tribune. He has a new collection of poems and short stories called Walking the Res Road. Res is short for reservation. This is his poem, Brown and White Peak.
What's it like living on the res, I'm always asked. It's living near a lot of relatives, ready to help or gossip about your need for help. The word reservation is a misnomer. Reserved for who? The white man owns 80% of my res, Fond du Lac. Living there means finding something good in something grim. Glad for our chronic unemployment when the white guys get lung cancer from breathing asbestos at the mill. 70% unemployment on the res. Go down the road a few miles, it's 5%. We have TV, that window to America. We see you. You don't see us. I watch the news every night. Whenever they show Indians, it's always that same tired tub of walleye, maybe some kind of bingo doings. Commodities are good for you, our nutritionist says. Right. They let your stomach know your swallower still works. Eat them for the bulk, not the taste. Rice Krispies now come in commods, in addition to the Spanish lesson printed on every box and can. Cereal de arroz tostado, anyone? We live strong because we know we're just one of the generations of people called Anishinaabe. Our spirituality protects us from the excesses of the manifest destiny, dominant society. What's it like living on the res? Come walk a mile in my moccasins. Maybe we can pick up some commods.
Thanks for reading that. Why did you decide to move back to the reservation?
I always knew that I would be returning to the reservation. It seems like most Indian people I know have a large rubber band attached to them. And they go away all over the world for different lengths of time, but they always return. And so, for my part, I just got tired of living near a lot of strangers.
Would you describe the reservation that you live on?
It's woods. Back around the turn of the century, it was big pine. I think most of our wood went down to Chicago to rebuild after the fire. Lakes, wild rice lakes, mostly woods and swamps. They tell us we have a lot of peat resources, but no one's exploiting that particular resource at this time.
Are there many people on the reservation who kind of remember traditional ways, or do you feel that that's something that's been lost?
I think we are in very good shape as far as remembering the traditional ways, the traditional stories. Right now, we're forming a new tradition with the casinos.
Is that something you support or oppose?
I'm still of two minds about it. The part I don't like about it is one of the things that's helped us survive on this continent for thousands of years is our willingness to share, our generosity. And gambling, to me, seems to be diametrically opposed to that. That's one of the bad parts. One of the good parts is the jobs. Most of my family is working at the casino now.
So you've got this new reservation. I mean, you've got this new casino on the reservation. At the same time, you are trying to live a more traditional lifestyle. What does that mean, the traditional lifestyle?
I live my life with the seasons. The seasons dictate my activities. In the spring, I make maple syrup and I spear fish. I was recently arrested for it because it's against the state law. But according to the 1854 and the 1837 treaty, we reserved the right to hunt, fish, and gather. So we'll be going to court in another couple of weeks about that. In the summertime, I make birch bark fanning baskets called Nuskatchinoggin, used for winnowing wild rice, separating the hulls from the grain. And then, of course, in a couple of weeks, we'll be starting to harvest wild rice and turn it into food. And then the hunting season is here, and we'll hunt moose and deer. rabbits and ducks, put away food for the winter. And then the winter time, of course, is a storytelling time, and that's when I do the bulk of my writing.
Right. The state law that you were being charged with breaking when you were spearfishing, was that because you were catching fish that aren't legally supposed to be caught, or is it because of the method of fishing with a spear?
The method of fishing, using a light and possessing a spear before the normal Minnesota spearfishing season, which is usually the winter.
Oh, I see. So you were doing it out of season. That's what it was? That's what
Well, out of season and using a light.
Using a light.
Yeah, I've got a motorcycle headlight rigged up to a motorcycle helmet that runs to a car battery. It's probably 100,000 candle power, and with that light, I can see the fish.
You know, that doesn't sound real traditional to me. I guess what you're doing is a real mix of contemporary technology and tradition.
Yes, I'm not trying to live 100 years ago. I believe a culture has to change to survive, and this is one of the many changes.
I want to ask you a little bit about the tradition that you're from. You're Chippewa?
Yes, we're also called Ojibwe, and our name for ourselves is Anishinaabe.
And what does that mean?
The literal definition of Anishinaabe is from whence descended the male of the species, or the original man.
And are there particular, this is a real outsider kind of question, so forgive me, but are there particular parts of Chippewa culture that you feel relate to your life, you know, the way you're trying to live it?
Yes, I believe it's the strength that comes from the old stories, the instructions on how to live a good life. Those pieces relate to the way I live mine.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jim Northrup, and he lives on the Fond du Lac Reservation near Duluth, Minnesota. And he has a new book of poems and short stories called Walking the Res Road. He also writes a syndicated newspaper column. I'm interested in your background. I know that you were forced to go to a federal boarding school when you were 6 years old. You actually have a poem about that called Ditched. Can I ask you to read it?
Sure. Ditched. A first grader, a federal boarding school, Pipestone, said Aneen to the first grown-up. Got an icy blue-eyed stare in return. Got a beating from a second grader for crying about the stare. Couldn't tell Ma or Dad. Both were 300 miles away. Couldn't write. Didn't know how. Couldn't mail. Didn't know how. Run away. Got caught. Got an icy blue stare and a beating. Got another beating from a second grader for crying about the blue-eyed beating. Institutionalized. Toughed it out. Survived.
How did you manage to get sent away at the age of six? What happened?
I think it was common practice at the time to try to educate us in the white man's way and try to separate us from our culture, and it seemed to be quite effective because there are some things that about our history, about our language, that I don't know that I would have ordinarily learned had I been at home.
Did your parents approve of your going? Did they want you to stay home?
They wanted me to stay home, but there was some economic coercion and some government coercion to send myself and my sister to this boarding school.
What seemed the most foreign to you about life at this school?
Not hearing my language, not hearing the stories, not hearing a drum.
So did you grow up speaking your native language?
Yes.
Which is,
and I grew up hearing the drum every weekend.
What was the occasion for the drum?
Just a dance, a social dance and ceremonies.
After several years at this school, you were sent to a Christian high school. Whose decision was that?
Once again, I think it was economic coercion.
What do you mean by that?
People would talk to my parents and say, well, you have 12 children here. If we take two of them off your hands, it'll be easier for the rest of them. So my older sister and I were selected as the sacrificial lambs.
So when you got out of school, you had spent like your entire childhood in institutions far away from home. What did you do next? Suddenly you had the choice of going where you wanted to go. Where did you go?
I joined another institution, the United States Marine Corps.
Was the thought of freedom too much to handle?
No, it wasn't that so much. It was the idea that we are warriors, and it was my turn.
Because of the Vietnam War?
No, this is before the Vietnam War. This was in the early 60s, 1961 I joined, right after high school.
You did end up in Vietnam.
Yes.
For what, a year?
13 months and 9 days.
Yeah, you were counting. What about your time in Vietnam? Did that fit in with the warrior tradition that you had in your mind?
Yes, it did. I was an infantryman, and I spent a lot of time walking through the rice paddies and the jungles with a rifle, looking for people who were looking for me.
You have some very bitter poems about the war.
It was probably the most traumatic event in my life. The boarding schools and the life on the reservation was small compared to the things that were happening in Vietnam.
Let me ask you to read a poem that's actually about your brother.
Yes. It's called Wabigan. Did you ever hear a sound, smell something, taste something that brought you back to Vietnam instantly? Did you ever wonder when it would end? It ended for my brother. He died in the war, but didn't fall down for 15 tortured years. His flashbacks are over. Another casualty whose name will never be on the wall. Some can only find peace in death. The sound of his family crying hurt. The smell of the flowers didn't comfort us. The bitter taste in my mouth still sours me. How about a memorial for those who made it through the war, but still died before their time?
How did your brother die?
Alcohol was involved and a motor vehicle was involved. And we're not sure of all of the details, just that he ended up dead.
And you connect this with his experiences in Vietnam?
Yes. He had never really settled back into society after the war.
Did you have trouble settling into?
Yes, I did.
What kind of trouble?
I knew there was something wrong with me when I came back. I was what it was later called post-traumatic stress disorder. I was going through that before it had a name. And I just knew there was something wrong with me. I was tense. I was always alert. Wasn't sleeping very good. And basically, I wanted to stay drunk all the time.
How did you stop drinking?
I realized what it was doing to me. I talked with one of my older uncles who had been in Guadalcanal in the South Pacific in World War II. And he told me that the memories will never go away, but drinking intensifies them. So I decided I didn't want any more intense memories of the war.
Did you find that there were a lot of Native Americans like you and like your brother who were in the war, came back, and had a really hard time adjusting?
I think actually we had an easier time because of the respect that veterans have in the Indian community. Before I left, I went through a ceremony with my grandfather, and when I came back, I had ceremonies. So actually, I think because of the way people feel about veterans, we did have an easier time than most non-Indian veterans.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jim Northrup. He lives on the Fond du Lac Reservation near Duluth, Minnesota. He's the author of the new book, Walking the Res Road, which collects his poems and short stories. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Native American writer Jim Northrup is my guest. Now, you became a sheriff for a while. I'm not sure where or...
On the reservation.
Oh, on the reservation.
Yeah.
How long was that after the war?
About a year and a half.
What was it? Yeah, go ahead.
At the time, I was an adrenaline junkie. After being in combat, life is pretty tame. So as a deputy sheriff, I had the trappings of the uniform. I carried a weapon. and I was making split-second life and death decisions.
How long did you stay in that job?
2 years as a deputy sheriff, and then I went down to Waukegan, Illinois, where I became a city police officer.
Really? How did you like that?
Once again, it satisfied my need for adrenaline. But I was worried about the person I was changing into. My wife would tell me it was raining, and I would always have to look outside to make sure. I didn't believe anyone, and the world was divided between us and them, those with a badge and those without.
Is that why you gave it up?
Yes.
Well, how did you get from this high adrenaline kind of life, the need to like always be in danger, I guess, to the life that you're living now, where you're a writer, you're trying to live a more traditional lifestyle? It seems like a pretty big change to me.
Actually, the change took quite a few years. Over the years, I've noticed that as I get older, I don't need that adrenaline as much as I used to when I was 25 or 30.
Your grandfather, I believe, was a writer.
Yes.
What kind of writing did he do?
Basically, he was an ombudsman for the people who couldn't speak English. But he would take time out from that to write stories. He wrote a long novella called Wawina. It is a story about the coming of the Black Robes, the Catholic priests, and it was set in the 1600s. And when he was writing, he would also explain things about our culture and our beliefs and just the day-to-day life.
Can I ask how your grandfather got an Anglo name? An anglicized name?
I'm not sure. It happened in 1886. Before our name was Northrop, it was Winnebujou, who, if you're familiar with Chippewa stories, is a man who is half god and half man. So that was our tribal name on my father's side before we became Northrop.
Mm-hmm. No, so, yeah, go ahead.
I'm really not sure how it happened.
Mm-hmm. You created a character who is it's a recurring character through a lot of your stories. His name is Luke Warmwater. Tell me about the character, about naming him.
I actually stole the name from my uncle, who used to use it back in the 50s when he was, he would travel to Minneapolis or St. Paul and meet someone, and he would register in a hotel as Luke Warmwater. And I chose it because it illustrates how Chippewas use humor as a survival tool.
did people pick up on that?
They eventually do. At first glance, they don't, but then eventually they say, hey, I know what you're saying.
So tell me about the character that you've given that name to.
I guess he's a character who's experienced some of the things that I've experienced in my life. Kind of a happy-go-lucky, devil-may-care sort of person who always seems to look for the humor in any situation. Once again, to illustrate that humor is a survival tool. We're not the cigar store kind of Indians. Or, as one of the writers put it, we don't let cigar stores sneak up behind us.
You know, I have to say, you've compared this character to you. You haven't given a lot of indications during this interview that you're the happy-go-lucky type.
Oh, but I am. My column called Fond du Lac Follies has a section called Question of the Month, where I just try to answer the sometimes silly questions white people ask us, and some of the answers are sarcastic, some of them are silly, but I just have a lot of fun with it.
What are some of those questions so I can try to make sure not to ask them?
Question, do you speak your language? Answer, yep, yours too. Or, question, are you full-blooded Indian? Answer, pint low, just got back from the blood bank.
Yeah.
Or, question, why do you call it a res instead of a reservation? Answer, because the white man owns most of it.
Oh, what are the big controversies you've been writing about in your column lately?
I've been writing about spearfishing, of course, since I'm in Mille Lacs County. My name is defendant. I've been writing about spearfishing, and I've been writing about the new casino that opened up.
Mm-hmm.
They originally told us it would cost $3 million, and now it's up to $7 million, and they're projecting $27 million. And it's kind of frightening to me, who is living close to the poverty line, to hear people talking about a million here and a million there. So I've been writing about that. I've been writing about the Jay Treaty of 1794 that allows Indians access back and forth across the Canadian-U.S. border. In fact, I just took part in a rally to demonstrate our concern about that. Treaty rights is one of my recurring issues. Gambling, that always seems to come up.
Mm-hmm.
And when the tribal government takes a two-week workshop in Reno, and the workshop is canceled, but they still go, I write about things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like the Jack Anderson of the reservation.
So one last question. What kind of work are you doing for the rest of the month in terms of the more traditional work that you've been doing?
Well, now we're in the preparing for wild rice, so I'm making sure that my canoe is seaworthy. I'm making sure that I have my rice knockers and my pole is strong enough to propel me through the rice. Yesterday I was in a PBS movie.
You really are living in two different cultures at the same time.
Yes, I sometimes come to the city and I forget to lock my car or take the keys out. And at home, I carefully lock it up in the driveway. So sometimes I have my city eyes on and at the wrong time.
I want to thank you awfully much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jim Northrup's new book, Walking the Res Road, is published by Voyager Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.